Mary Pat Whaley is a mover and a shaker. She's a LinkedIn influencer. She's got a big list of email subscribers. But you know who she really cares about? The small healthcare practice. She has been writing and blogging and talking about the importance of helping small independent businesses stay viable. And that's what she does at Manage My Practice. Join us for a Get Social Health interview with Mary Pat Whaley.
Welcome to Get Social Health, a conversation about social media and how it's being used to help hospitals, social practices, healthcare practitioners, and patients connect and engage via social media. Get Social Health brings you conversations with professionals actively working in the field and provides real-life examples of healthcare social media in action. Here is your host, Janet Kennedy.
Welcome to Get Social Health. Joining me this morning is Mary Pat Whaley. She is the founder and CEO of Manage My Practice. It's a consulting firm that helps new healthcare practices get up and running. Her company's mission is to create sustainable financial viability for the small independent physician practices because she just can't imagine a world without physicians practicing medicine the way they want to. She is also a LinkedIn influencer with a following of almost 300,000. Welcome to Get Social Health, Mary Pat.
Thank you, Janet. It is a pleasure to be here, and thanks for inviting me.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. And in the unique, it's a small world after all, I was aware of you as a LinkedIn influencer. I was aware of the webinars that you delivered on practice management through a company that I work with. And I was shocked to find out that you actually live near me.
It is a small world, especially in healthcare.
Absolutely. And the crossover of individuals is really quite amazing and really beneficial. And one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about is about the small practice and how people find you. So tell me a little bit about Manage My Practice and how you go about finding clients or physicians or healthcare practices to work with.
Well, it's very interesting, and of course, since we're talking about social media today, I have to tell you that almost exclusively all of our clients come to us because they find us on the internet. We work nationally, actually internationally. We have a couple of clients outside of the United States, and everyone found us because we started putting content on the web in 2008, and that content has, that diligence in posting good quality content has paid off, because that's people come to us through information through LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, direct to our website, and that's how they find us.
So you were a very avid blogger way back in the old days of 2008.
Way back in the old days, we happened to be living in Seattle at the time, and I kind of had an idea that technology was coming to healthcare and that small practices were going to be left in the dust, and that there was no place that you could really find information about technology. And so I just sort of jumped in and with some help of some friends got my first website up and running and just started blogging. And everything, someone had told me at the time, if you just blog every day or every week without fail for 2 years, it's going to make a significant difference to your business. And that's absolutely what happened.
Oh, fascinating. So what kind of topics were you blogging on?
I was blogging, initially the slant was more about technology when technology kind of wasn't pervasive into every aspect of healthcare the way it really is now in 2015. And so I was focusing on technology, but then just found, that everything started changing so fast in healthcare that I was never without something to talk about, whether it was things to do with Medicare, whether it was something, you know, that I had learned on my travels in practice management over 30 years. There was just always something to write about. So it ended up being, you know, everything to do with small practice and sometimes large practice management. I mean, there are things that apply to everybody, but just wrote whatever I thought, you know, was interesting to me, and so I thought it might be interesting to other people.
So when you say technology, are you talking about websites? Are you talking about electronic health records?
Well, initially, really electronic health records, I would say. When I realized how significant electronic health records was going to be and how practice managers, administrators, healthcare executives were going to have to get their arms around. You know, it's one thing for a non-clinical person, which most of us are, to understand billing and practice management, analytics and reporting in a non-clinical way. But then suddenly when this all applies to the medical record, you know, that's a huge shift. So I happened to attend something on the Microsoft campus with Dr. Bill Krauts, where I did a little interview with him, and he was talking about how everything was going to significantly change for physicians with the EMR. I don't think I understood at the time what he was talking about, but really he was talking about the free EMR and what an impact on the landscape that was going to have. And it certainly has. That's a very, very significant change, and one that has made it possible for us to set up physicians in new practice and other providers in new practice is the free EMR.
Share with me a little bit about what exactly is Manage My Practice. What do you do for your clients?
Well, what we try to be is a small practice resource, and we actually started out thinking that we would be doing much more billing-focused things, revenue management, revenue cycle management, and we do that, but in addition to that, we also set up new providers in practice, as I mentioned. We have a program called Credit Card on File where we help physicians and other providers to make the billing process with patients electronic and much more intuitive and efficient. We do fractional practice administration, which means for small practices that may not have the need or the dollars for a full-time, highly skilled practice administrator. We come in and work with them. I say we come in, we do everything virtually. Work with them anywhere from 2 hours a week to 2 hours a month to just kind of give them that little shot in the arm of a high-level practice administrator. We're coders and billers, so we do chart audits, coding, a lot of ICD-10 education, HIPAA, and OSHA compliance training. Really just about anything that a small practice would need.
I'm thinking to myself now that all of those things you mentioned are very important skill sets that would take a long time to learn just off the cuff. So if somebody is starting a new practice and say they want to hire someone to be their business manager, that's a very specialized set of skills to expect somebody to have.
It really is, and people like that are hard to find because they're kind of like me in terms of they may have turned to consulting or they may have kind of gone up to working at for larger groups, and also a lot of people like that are employed by the hospitals. So it is not easy, and of course the physician, the owner of the practice, has a full-time job providing care. And so it sometimes can be very hard for him or her to also cover that managerial or that business role. A lot of the people that we work with are spouse teams, which is very exciting for us because the husband or the wife or the spouse will be the provider and the other partner will know something about business, but maybe not about healthcare. And so we do a lot of coaching with these spouse teams to get them up and running and understand the business of healthcare. And I think that's a great recipe for keeping independent physicians thriving, is that nice spouse team. You know, when somebody's lucky enough to have, you know, someone who wants to work with them in their own private practice.
So is one of your services on your web, not listed on your website, as marriage counseling?
Well, we do get into some psychology, but no, I can't say that we do marriage counseling. We just try to, you know, we fix the money first. It's always, when we work with a client, we always try and get the money right, because when people don't have to be so worried about the money, they can focus on other kinds of things. You know, when you're worried about the money, everything is difficult.
Well, I think that's also the number one reason that marriages have challenges, is it's financial. So
right.
If they're not having to struggle with that, that certainly helps keep everything on an even keel.
That's right.
I wanted to ask you about your clients. They're not necessarily all physicians per se. Is that correct?
That's correct. Things have radically changed in the United States over the past 10 years. And so in many states, nurse practitioners and PAs and RNs and can own practices, can start healthcare entities. You know, at the other end of the spectrum, we have, you know, corporate medicine, which are, you know, companies that are not necessarily owned by people with clinical backgrounds, but that employ physicians, NPs, PAs, and so forth. So, you know, the medical practice is not just the purview of the physician anymore. And even though there's a lot of controversy about that, I think that's a very good thing. Not all the models are great, but because there is a shortage of physicians, you know, the fact that other people are able to go into business for themselves and provide healthcare, I think is a very good thing.
Help me understand what it's like for someone coming out of a medical school. Is there any business training at all as part of their training?
Well, it varies from program to program. They certainly have tried very hard to introduce business concepts into medical school. But like most things, it's the you know, the application, not necessarily the theory. We do have a lot more physicians and other providers going to business school to try to learn. But, you know, generally people come out of residency having had limited training. And if they have been working for hospitals, and a lot of physicians coming right out of residency do work for the hospitals because, number one, guaranteed salary, and number two, they have a huge medical school debt that, you know, they're trying to get out from under. But not working for the hospital doesn't necessarily teach you anything about being in practice for yourself. So the internet has done a lot to provide information. We provide a lot of information. There are a lot of independent physician groups, societies, and professional groups that also provide information. The AMA has come to the party a little bit with information on starting your own medical practice, but it's still a pretty daunting idea for all but the most really entrepreneurial or visionary physicians.
I'm envisioning that your clients are predominantly, what, in their early 30s, right out of residency or something like that. But am I wrong, or are they all ages? Who are your typical clients?
There is no typical client, I have to say. It's very interesting because we don't have a lot of physicians coming right out of residency, just kind of for the reasons that I mentioned. They have a huge debt that they're trying to pay off. Very few physicians come out of school without, you know, a significant debt. And so that's not necessarily, you know, a great beginning to either borrow some more money or, you know, that they don't have something saved up to get started in private practice. So, yes, we do have a couple here and there. Most of our clients have been in practice either with a group or with a hospital for some number of years, you know, 2 to 10 before they decide they want to go on their own. But we also have physicians who are starting over. We have physicians who are in their 50s and even 60s who are retiring from their first job with a hospital or academic center, or whatever, and wanting to go into private practice, typically, you know, in a whole new place and with a whole new model. So it's, we've had physicians and other providers who are buying a practice and, you know, are going from one situation to now being the owner. They're not, they're starting something new, but it's because they're purchasing a practice. So all kinds of different scenarios.
Are you picking up concierge-based clients, and is there anything different about how they manage their practice versus a traditional practice?
Well, concierge is one of those words that I think for the most part, you know, people see it in one way, but we tend to talk about practices as a retainer based practice, with concierge kind of being the very, very high level, the sort of VIP. But there are so many new models of practice that maybe have some components of concierge that you have to kind of distinguish them. So there are true concierge practices where physicians may or may not be accepting insurance, and they're charging a very high, usually annual rate for their services and for very personal attention. But then you also have cash practices that are on sort of the level that every person can afford. You have direct pay practices where there's a monthly fee that covers the majority of primary care that somebody needs. There's fee for service, which is pretty much like the insurance-based practice, except for it's an all-cash practice. And because there's no insurance involved and the practice doesn't file anything for the patient, that's usually extremely affordable. So we see lots of different cash components mixed in with insurance components in all kinds of different ways. And for a lot of practices, there does need to be some sort of cash component, because the only way people are really making it in a true 100% insurance-based practice is if they are fortunate to have really good contracts, because the reimbursement just keeps on dropping and dropping and dropping, and we know expenses are going up. So, you know, in many ways, cash is king in the independent practice. It's just to what degree cash is employed as a component of that practice that is how we fit it to each physician's vision of their practice. Some physicians really want to work with Medicare and Medicaid, and other physicians say, I'm sorry, but I can't afford to see patients with Medicare and Medicaid, and so forth.
I had a OBGYN who was probably the best doctor I've ever had. I mean, the perfect combination of calm assurance and empathy, and she was just wonderful. But she was a solo practitioner, and she just kind of got to a point where she was going to have to make some expensive decisions about EHR, and decided that she just was going to close her practice, predominantly because she didn't have the negotiation power and was still working off like a I don't know, a 1998 insurance pay structure because she had no pull with the insurance companies. Is that something that you run into a lot, and do you help them manage that?
Well, definitely. And, you know, there's no, you know, a lot of clients come to us and say, I know a solo doctor can't negotiate anymore. And that's just not true. So much depends on the community and the environment in which you're going to practice. We have very successfully negotiated increases in contracts, but we would never say, oh, we know the secrets to that. We can do that for everybody. Healthcare is local. Everything depends on what's going on in the environment in which the provider is going to practice, the competition, you know, how much of the market the hospital has, how much diversity in payers there are. And of course, we know from this year that we are already starting to see more consolidation of the payers, you know, with payers getting ready to merge. And the solo practitioner, unless he or she is has something very special to bring to the table, if they're in an overserved area, it can be extremely difficult. I'm working with one very similar to what you're talking about, one practice that wants to go from an insurance-based practice to a cash-based practice. And because of what's going on in healthcare locally for them, they have very little to bring to the table in trying to renegotiate their contracts. So I hate to hear that someone who was providing good care, like your physician, decided just to close doors because there are so many more options now to just saying, well, if I can't get the rates from insurance and I can't work 24 hours a day, I'm going to have to close. Physicians don't have to do that anymore.
Well, I'm going to talk to her. Maybe she'll consider going back in. She's going to come visit you. She still has her office. She hasn't been able to sell that. So, I have to think about that.
Yeah.
Well, how about the difference between, say, an OBGYN practice versus, say, an oncology or sports medicine or family practice? For what you do for them, is it different based on the specialty?
Yes, absolutely. You know, right now, one of the differences is whether or not that provider has big ticket items. So we're talking about surgery. Primary care is in its own world for the most part because they have fairly low ticket items. You're not racking up big bills for primary care. You've got annual well visits, sick visits, possibly some vaccines, depending upon the primary care, some management of chronic illnesses and so forth. When you get to surgeons, and this includes, gynecologists who do surgery and the OB who catch babies or do surgery, orthopedics, neurosurgeons, you know, patients don't have an unending source of money for those kind of very pricey procedures. And so one of the things that we see happening is the promotion of paying for primary care separately than paying for the high ticket items. And we're also seeing right there on the line in the middle is for some testing and imaging. We're starting to see cash-based MRIs and CTs, because those, even though they're high ticket items, those can be provided on a cash basis for significantly less. One of the things that was allowed and even promoted in the ACA, one of the things that is allowed is the ability to kind of have what we call wraparound insurance coverage, so that kind of like you pay for all the basics for your car, but then you have car insurance for the big stuff. That's the most typical analogy. So yes, the specialty does make a difference. Oncology is as a medical specialty is not surgery, but when you think about the expense of the chemotherapy, that's very rarely something that patients can pay out of pocket. So this kind of distinction between maintenance and small problems for primary care being paid out of pocket by the patient, and then the wraparound insurance coverage for the big things is something that is definitely people are trying to figure it out right now. People are trying to figure out how that can work. And employers in particular are seeing a big benefit to having primary care handled on a one fee, per, as opposed to these huge premiums that they're paying for all care covered by an insurance company. I don't know if I went too far with that answer, but I hope that helped to distinguish. And also, let me just mention this, some physicians are going into functional and integrative medicine models where they are focusing more differently, maybe away from procedures and into more prevention and wellness and lots of different modalities to address, the kind of problems that we have in the United States with, obesity and diabetes being, two of the primary problems we deal with. I'll stop there.
No, actually, I'm absolutely fascinated. And I can tell by the amount of knowledge you have, A, how complicated it all is. But, gee, how do you know all that? What's your background, Mary Pat?
Well, I have a sort of a strange background. I never intended to go into healthcare, but my very first job in the 80s was as a temporary receptionist in an orthopedic office, and I just kind of fell in love with it. It is a very satisfying thing to be able to help people in a non-clinical way. I don't have a clinical background, in an administrative way. And so I just sort of, cut my teeth on managing smaller practices. At a certain point, I felt I had to understand more about the hospital world. And so started working with hospitals that had employed physicians and worked on that side of things. Ultimately decided that I wanted to work with independent practices and found that there's just not a whole lot of services and resources out there for them. A lot of consulting groups are not really interested in working with small practices. They don't have the big bucks. And so, 30 years of managing practices in the public and the private sector, for-profit, non-for-profit, I just pretty much did everything and arrived at consulting. And of course, along the way, started the blog. I started the blog way before I even considered consulting, just because I saw a need and enjoy writing and really thought that I needed to understand everything there is to know about social media and ultimately leverage social media for myself while, preaching the word. We didn't really talk about social media that we provide to our clients, which is really more concepts of social media and encouragement, helping physicians and other providers to see where a digital presence is extremely important to the, ability of their practice to thrive.
All right, well, let's talk about that for a second. You've got the small practice, maybe the solo practitioner. They're awfully busy. Fortunately, they were smart and they hired Manage My Practice, so they've got the understanding that there's somebody helping guide the business side. But how does an individual engage in social media? How do you recommend they engage in social?
Well, we always see the website as, the hub of the wheel and then the spokes going out. Being Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Google Plus, whatever it's going, you know, whatever's going to be the right components for them. But, you know, a lot about your digital presence has to do with, you know, who you all are in the market and what is the demographic you're trying to attract. So the website, it is not a one size fits all, and we don't actually, that's one of the things we don't do in the setup of a new practice is we do not build or support websites. So that's something that we help the physician to find the right partner for them to build the website, to create something that's a reflection of the practice. And we have clients that are all the way from sort of the old-fashioned brochure website, so to speak, that is not very interactive, doesn't have a lot of its information, where to find us, what we do, and how we do it, because those particular clients are in an underserved area. They're taking insurance, and so they have lots of other ways for patients to come to them. So a fairly low-level website, and believe it or not, you can do your own website through Vistaprint for $199 a year, and we had a client that did that, and that was a good fit for him. And that was okay. That when you think about social media, you don't think about, you know, a four-page website that, you know, doesn't really do anything, that just sort of lays there. But that's what was needed. The whole way up to the other end, to a very, very specialized website that not only had to reflect the very specialized services, cash services that the physician was offering, you know, but also had to be extremely well optimized for search engines, because this provider was going to attract patients. Patients would be driving, you know, probably up to an hour or more to get to this physician. So the web presence was extremely important. So those are kind of the two ends of that basic hub, and everything fits in between based on, you know, how much of a niche that physician is going to have, how far away that physician is going to have to attract people, how important is that digital presence. And then from there, we start working on the spokes based on who the target demographic is. Does that answer your question?
It does. And I know one of the things you do for a new practice is sort of a market analysis. What kind of things are you looking at that help drive decisions for a new practice?
Well, of course, number one, the vision of the person in the practice, the provider, the physician, the nurse practitioner, the physician assistant. What is the vision? Who do they want to serve? And is that realistic? Of course, we run the numbers ultimately for the vision to see, is that realistic? But, you know, what is the competition in the community? What is the demographic of the community? You know, is that community well enough populated and well enough funded to avail themselves of the service of this practitioner? You know, what are the role of the hospitals in the community? For instance, in rural communities, we still have hospitals able to financially help new physicians start in practice because, you know, their community is so underserved. And then you'll find in metro areas where there's so much service, you know, hospitals are not helping any physicians to get started. As a matter of fact, they have their own employed physicians. So they're, you know, it's pretty much a closed shop, so to speak. So understanding the employers in the community and what type of insurance products those employers are offering, understanding what's going on in the community with exchange plans, which are, you know, a two-edged sword, more people insured, but high deductibles, and so that has to be managed. So just really getting a good feel for the lay of the land in terms of what kind of an environment. Is this an environment that a physician can thrive in? And if we're heading for a particular niche, you know, a dermatologist on a California coast town, where there's already, you know, a dermatologist for every five people, you know, what's different? If you're going to compete in a market that's already overserved, what's going to be different about what you're going to do? Because if you're just going to get out there and do general dermatology in coastal California, it's going to be tricky. You're going to have a hard time competing.
Do you often have practices that actually have advertising budgets?
Well, because we tend to do more of the marketing comes from our new clients as opposed to our established, you know, people that come to us. Sometimes we'll be doing marketing, but just to give you some insight, for a new practice, we kind of just put one big budget item in. Again, depending upon their specialty and their vision and what they're going for, we usually put about $10,000 in for startup, for website, promotions, open house, any kind of collateral or brochures. We do have in some markets people doing advertising on the radio, television, NPR, newsprint, that kind of thing. Depending on their market and what they're going for, some of those things are too costly and not a good fit, and other things are just perfect for them. As far as practices, actually putting existing practices, putting money aside for marketing, in the small practice sector, we don't see that a lot. That's more of a large practice, you know, that really concentrates on that and, you know, attributes 1% of revenue or 2% of revenue for marketing.
So as we start to wrap up the conversation, do you have any words of wisdom that you would share with someone who is beginning to think about going out on their own, whether they're leaving a hospitalist environment or they're just coming out of school and residency and wanting to start their own practice? What kind of things should they be thinking about before they just jump out there and commit?
Well, one thing that I would say is, even though it's good to talk to a lot of people, don't be put off by people that say, you're crazy, don't go into, you know the hospitals are buying the practices, this is, you know, you're going to fail. Don't buy into that. I mean, take everything everybody says with a grain of salt. I would say that hospitals and major media have done a really good job of trying to convince the American public that independent practice is going away, but I'm here to tell you it's not. So don't just necessarily listen to the people in your community who you might say, I'm thinking about going into private practice, and they would scoff at it. Look on the internet. There's so much on the internet. There's so many great resources for physicians and other providers that are making a go of private practice. There's podcasts, there's websites, there's organizations, there's a lot to it. So you do have to do your due diligence. I think you have to really understand what your motivation for going into independent practice is. You know, you have to be prepared to put a lot into it. You know, when we get into setting up a new practice and working through the pro forma and talking through the different things that are necessary, sometimes physicians are just blown away by how much there is to it. There is a lot to it, and physicians are the ones who are doing the work and then trying to manage the business. And as a consultant and a small business owner, you know, I can relate. I have a hard time doing consulting and managing my business and my team. There's so many hours in the day. But don't be dissuaded, you know. Don't there are so many. I'm working on a PowerPoint right now that I'm going to try and publish in the next couple weeks about the 12 models of medical practice. There are so many new ways to practice medicine. It doesn't have to be, you know, a 2,000 square foot building next to a hospital with five staff. It doesn't have to be that at all, and it doesn't have to cost the world. Some physicians come to me and say, I don't have $100,000 to start a practice. Well, you don't need $100,000 to start a practice. And the free EMR is just one example of how physicians can do what they need to do at a very, very low or no cost. It's really changed the landscape for physicians.
Well, it's a good thing you're staying on top of it, because it sounds like there is something happening every day.
There certainly is. Healthcare is, you know, you just got, it's a wave. It's a wave that we're all trying to ride.
I now have visions of you up on a surfboard, and that just...
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's great. Mary Pat, thank you so much for joining me here today, and I really look forward to continued conversations as we try to help small and solo practitioners be successful as business people and as healthcare practitioners and just in general as members of their community.
Thank you, Janet. It was a lot of fun.
And now, here's your social media success tip.
Hi, I'm Tal Givoli, CEO and co-founder of Medivisor. That's MediVizor.com. Tweeting as either Givoli, at Givoli, or at Medivisor. And my social media tip is that if you're looking for health information online, especially in social media and on Twitter, for instance, you need to really figure out who are you listening to? And do research those accounts. See who else is retweeting them. See what are they talking about, and can you really trust it? Because there are a lot of bad information on Twitter. A lot of people that are promoting various cures to now yet incurable diseases, and it's really scary. And they create false hope. So I highly encourage you to vet your sources as much as possible. There's no way to go get about doing this but to actually use your better judgment, but to look to the source, see who else is amplifying their content and what it is.
You've been listening to the Get Social Health podcast. The show notes are located at getsocialhealth.com. To join our healthcare social media journey, follow at Get Social Health on Twitter and start a conversation.
It's always a pleasure to have someone on the podcast who is really living it in the trenches, and certainly that's Mary Pat's situation. Thank you so much for listening, and I really appreciate your being here today. If you want to understand a little bit more about how to manage social media in the trenches, I invite you to check out GetSocialHealthAcademy.com. I've got a series of online courses there specifically for the small healthcare practice. We address a lot of basic social media 101, but it's always with the understanding of an appreciation for HIPAA, privacy laws, and the unique ways of marketing a healthcare practice. If you stop by GetSocialHealthAcademy.com/pilot, you'll get a chance to participate for a limited time at a limited low rate in a special introductory course where I'm actually sharing four courses with you, getting your feedback, and then we'll use that to build an even more better course, which you'll also be entitled to get forever and ever. So reach out at GetSocialHealthAcademy.com/pilot if you'd like to know more about the podcast or the program.